KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. This hour, the latest on the first major talks between the U.S. and Iran after President Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal in his first administration. And on-again, off-again tariffs have put a spotlight on America's love affair with cheap consumer products.
People are told and believe that their consumption is not only for their own good, but for the good of the nation.
Plus, throw a little something on the grill, a new museum dedicated to barbecue. It's Sunday, April 13th. More after the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. China is vowing to stay strong against the U.S. after President Trump imposed tariffs of 145% against Chinese products, with the exception of electronics such as smartphones and computers. Ke Yu Jin is an economist in Beijing and says Chinese leaders are preparing for an escalation of the trade war.
Chinese leaders really consider the tariffs now really as a blackmail. And from China's perspective, any concessions will lead to more demands from Trump. So it will stay strong. But if this escalates, China is more prepared than the last time around. And in fact, since Trump 1.0, the Chinese companies have been diversifying their supply chains, their factories. They're moving away from the sectors that are most vulnerable to U.S. exports.
She says Chinese leaders are open to reaching an agreement with the U.S. Israel has struck one of the last functioning hospitals in northern Gaza. The Israeli military says it targeted a Hamas command center in the hospital used to plan attacks against Israeli civilians and soldiers. It did not provide evidence. NPR's Anas Baba reports.
The Christian-affiliated Al-Ahli Hospital was struck on Palm Sunday. The Israeli strike caused massive damage to the emergency room, triage area, pharmacy, and the only X-ray machine in northern Gaza. Israel's military issued an evacuation warning before the strike. Hospital nurse Nibal Abu Asr says doctors and patients scrambled to flee in the middle of the night. She says a 10-year-old patient died after he was disconnected from oxygen supply. After the strike, hundreds of patients seeking treatment crowded the closed hospital gates. Palestinian health officials say more than 35 health centers in Gaza are out of service. Israel has an active ban on medicine and supplies from entering Gaza. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza.
The final round in Ecuador's presidential race is being decided today. Voters are set to choose between the conservative incumbent and a leftist challenger as the South American country deals with devastating violence. NPR's Carrie Khan reports international drug gangs are fighting for control.
The first 2 months of this year saw the homicide rate soar, with one killing occurring every hour. The current president, Daniel Noboa, Trump ally and son of one of the wealthiest men in Ecuador, has taken an iron fist approach to cracking down on the gangs. But several abuses by soldiers fighting crime groups and the rising violence have hurt his approval ratings. His challenger, Luisa Gonzalez, a protege of Ecuador's former leftist firebrand president, also advocates for a large military role, but she wants more spending on social programs and poverty relief. In the first round of the presidential contest, both candidates received about 44% of the vote. Polls show this round will be as close. Carrie Khan, NPR News, Guayaquil, Ecuador.
This is NPR News in Washington. Ukrainian officials say at least 32 people were killed this morning in a Russian missile attack in the northeastern city of Sumy. More than 80 others were wounded. Two ballistic missiles struck in the heart of the city as residents gathered to observe Palm Sunday. Earlier this month, some 20 people, including 9 children, were killed in an attack on Kryvyi Rih, the Ukrainian president's hometown. Economic uncertainty has traditionally given a boost to secondhand shopping. But as NPR's Rachel Treisman reports, thrift stores won't be immune to the effects of tariffs.
Americans looking to tighten their belts may decide to buy used in traditional thrift stores or online marketplaces. A March survey by one of those platforms, ThredUp, found that 59% of consumers say they would look for secondhand alternatives if government policies make clothes more expensive. But experts warn there's a catch. In tight economic times, people may be more hesitant to buy new clothes and donate their old ones. That could limit the secondhand supply and eventually drive up prices. They say now is a good time to rethink how much clothing you need to buy and prioritize pieces that will last a long time. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
This morning, the White House released what it says are the results of President Trump's physical exam last week. It listed his height as 75 inches and his weight at 224 pounds. The White House physician concluded that President Trump exhibits excellent cognitive and physical health and is fit to execute the duties of the commander-in-chief and head of state. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The U.S. and Iran are talking. They held their first high-level talks in years yesterday, and both sounded mildly encouraged afterward. The goal is a new deal on Iran's nuclear program. President Trump withdrew the U.S. from a previous agreement during his first term. We're joined now by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Good morning, Greg.
Hi, Aisha.
So the mere fact that the U.S. and Iran are meeting is news. But is there any reason yet to think that these talks will succeed?
So way too soon to say that. But Saturday's talks were an important first step. The U.S. and Iran held these talks in Oman's capital, Muscat, mediated by Oman. And the key issues are clear. What will the limits be on Iran's nuclear program? And to what extent will Iran get relief from the tough sanctions imposed by the U.S.? But both sides sounded very serious. The U.S. called the talks positive and constructive. Iran struck a similar note, and they've agreed to meet again on Saturday.
The previous nuclear deal was reached in 2015 under President Obama. It fell apart when Trump pulled out of it in 2018. But could that old agreement still offer a framework for a future deal?
So it could kind of cut both ways. On the one hand, the U.S. and Iran had to work out a lot of very complicated technical issues under that original agreement. Both sides learned what worked and what didn't. Now, I spoke about this with Alex Vatanka, an Iran expert at the Middle East Institute in Washington.
So much of the heavy lifting was done 10 years ago when it comes to a narrow agreement around the nuclear issue. They don't have to reinvent the wheel.
But some other things have changed. Iran has now enriched uranium to a much higher level, about 60% purity. That's not quite the level needed for a nuclear weapon, which would be around 90% purity. But it's close, and it's something Iran could do fairly quickly and move toward a bomb. And so the U.S. will have to win concessions just to get back to the point where we were in 2018. When Trump withdrew unilaterally, and Trump will certainly want a deal that he can present as better than the one that Obama cut.
What about Iran? How has its position changed since the original deal?
Well, Iran is vulnerable right now. Its economy is very fragile. It suffered military setbacks last year and missile exchanges with Israel, so it could be willing to make some compromises. Now, Iran will want to keep the talks narrowly focused on its nuclear program. Trump and his team have spoken about some broader goals like ending Iran's support for proxy groups in the region. Again, here's Alex Vatanka.
Neither side wants this to turn into a hot war. The Iranians certainly cannot afford it. And the Americans have other issues they want to worry about, not being dragged into another war in the Middle East.
So how do these negotiations fit in with Trump's broader goal in the Middle East?
Well, as we heard, Trump doesn't want to get bogged down in another Middle East conflict, and a nuclear deal would ease tensions. At the same time, Trump has been ramping up U.S. military involvement. The U.S. has been bombing for a month against the Houthis in Yemen, a group that Iran supports. So Trump is supporting negotiations for now, but he keeps warning that a military option is still on the table.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thank you so much.
Sure thing, Aisha.
If you're an investor close to retirement or an institution or foreign government looking to park money in a safe place with a set return, you choose U.S. Treasury bonds. They're called the safe harbor or the gold standard, to mix financial metaphors. And this past week, it was the bond markets that figured into President Trump's 90-day retreat on his new tariff regime.
Well, I thought that people were jumping a little bit out of line. They were getting yippy, you know? They were getting a little bit yippy, a little bit afraid.
Andrew Ackerman covers the Federal Reserve and financial regulation for the Washington Post, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what did the bond markets do that was so worrying to so many people?
There was a lot of volatility this last week in the stock market. And when that happens, typically people move into U.S. Treasury bonds. But that didn't happen this week. And so that sparked a lot of concern. Hey, what's going on here? Why are yields, which should normally be falling on U.S. Treasury bonds, why are they rising instead and rising dramatically?
So when we say yields, that's the money investors get back for investing in bonds. So a yield going up is good for the investor, but it means that the government needs to pay out more, right?
That's correct. U.S. government bonds are basically the bedrock of the entire global financial system. So in addition to the sheer size of the market, it's about $30 trillion. It plays this important role in financing U.S. budget deficits. You know, the U.S. government takes in only so much money, and the rest is financed with debt. The Treasury goes and issues these bonds, and they raise them from all kinds of investors. And then banks use them as collateral for loans as well. So basically, when you have problems in the Treasury bond market, it affects the interest rates that consumers pay on mortgages or car loans. It affects how millions of consumers and also businesses, how they borrow as well. You know, you have this market, it's not supposed to act like basically like a penny stock that's moving all over the place and very erratic. It's supposed to be very stable. And so when you see that yields are rising dramatically when they should be dropping, it's a big cause for concern.
Do we know why this is happening? Is there less confidence in U.S. Treasury bonds than in the past?
There are several reasons why the yields went up this past week. One possibility is that, you know, the Trump administration is in the middle of this trade war. The biggest foreign holders of U.S. Treasury bonds are China and Japan. There's all this speculation that maybe this is partly kind of retaliation. There's another question, like, is this a permanent restructuring? Do people just not see treasuries as safe anymore? We have the trade war. You have the president making very abrupt policy decisions kind of on his own. The other thing you're seeing is the fall in the dollar at the same time, which is also alarming. The dollar is also the global reserve currency, and its value went down this week as well. It raises a lot of concerns for people.
So what has been the Trump administration's response so far?
Trump, as I think you played the clip, he acknowledged on Wednesday that the reason he was pausing what he called reciprocal tariffs was, in fact, the bond market's reaction. He said people were getting queasy about the bond market. That's from the president himself. I think Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, who's sort of the chief economic spokesperson for the administration, he basically said it was these hedge funds who were deleveraging, that there was nothing systemic here. It was just this thing that happens every now and then, and a bunch of hedge funds were deleveraging, which is also probably true.
What did you make of that TikTok that Trump himself reposted, claiming that he's deliberately tanking the stock markets in order to drive money into Treasury bonds, forcing the Fed to lower rates and thereby allowing the U.S. to refinance its debt at those lower rates?
I mean, I don't think that that tracks with what's happening right now. The rates aren't going down. The prices are going down and the rates are going up. So, I mean, if that's the strategy, it doesn't seem to be working. And I don't think that those rates are going to translate into, for instance, lower mortgage costs.
That's Washington Post financial reporter Andrew Ackerman. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Where I come from, barbecue features vinegar. Where you come from, it may come with a tomato base or just smoke. There are many flavors of American barbecue. Now there's a museum devoted to it. And as member station KCUR's Frank Morris reports, it's in Kansas City, but isn't just about KCBBQ.
The Museum of Barbecue is in a mall. You walk through the gift shop to reach an 8-foot-tall, industrial-looking door with gauges, big handle. Jonathan Bender is the founder.
Our entrance to the museum is actually a replica of a large smoker door, a big commercial smoker door, the kind that you would cook hundreds of pounds of meat of barbecue on, in order to kind of have that moment, right, where you're leaving the world behind.
Inside, there's no actual smoke or any barbecue to eat, but lots of original art illustrating the many ways of seasoning and smoking meat. There's a big hands-on pork puzzle, a spice-smelling game, and a jump-in vat of plastic baked beans. Megan Harrison's just getting out of it.
Oh, it was super fun. I've never been in a bean pit before, only a ball pit. So I'm actually not a big bean person. I'm only a bean pit person.
If barbecue sauce is more your thing, there's a sauce immersion room with a squishy-looking floor.
So these are, they're called lava tiles. So you can actually walk on them, and they mimic kind of that movement of sauce, right? It moves under your feet, so they're bright orange, but they have this red underneath. Yeah, it's super fun.
Not all barbecue sauce is reddish. It's all over the place, from Alabama white sauce to black dip in Kentucky. Bender's Museum honors the complex geography with special attention to the four kingdoms of Q.
Carolinas, Memphis, Texas, and Kansas City all lay claim to being kind of their own capital.
And they all have a backstory. In Kansas City, enormous stockyards and slaughterhouses kept pitmasters of the 1920s stocked with beef. But that's not all they were smoking.
Back then, they cooked raccoon and possum and woodchuck, right? And so to cook something for a long amount of time at a low temperature to make it tender or succulent, you got to tend it, you got to work it, you got to love it.
Benner clearly loves barbecue. He spent 6 years getting this museum off the ground. He says it's the first and only one devoted to barbecue, Kansas City's culinary calling card. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. An Israeli strike hit a hospital in northern Gaza early today. Officials say one child died during an evacuation after being disconnected from the oxygen supply. Polls are open in Ecuador in that country's runoff election for president. The race is expected to be close between conservative incumbent Daniel Noboa and leftist Luisa Gonzalez. A top issue for voters is rising crime. And on this Palm Sunday, Pope Francis made a brief appearance at St. Peter's Square. He greeted crowds from his wheelchair at the end of the service. It was his second public appearance in St. Peter's Square after being discharged from the hospital 3 weeks ago. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Americans are used to bargains. Furniture, electronics, food, fashion, all produced overseas and often delivered to our front doors. Now the Trump administration's latest round of tariffs seeks to bring manufacturing back to the U.S., even if it means stopping the flow of cheap products. So how did cheap goods become so accessible in the U.S.? And is the American dream possible without them? Elizabeth Cohen is a professor of history at Harvard University and the author of A Consumer's Republic, The Politics of Mass Consumption in Postwar America. She joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So how did the U.S. become a place where most consumers, I mean, they really expect widespread access to affordable products?
Well, it didn't start that way. It's coming out of World War II and looking ahead to the post-war economy that I would argue the concept of an economy that would prosper based on mass consumption really takes off. It takes off in a way where people are told and believe that their consumption is not only for their own good, but for the good of the nation. There was a consensus between economic planners coming out of the New Deal. There were corporations and companies who believed this, and unions as well. The concept was you're going to pay workers well, they're going to buy things which will stoke the fires of factories, that will create more jobs and put more money in consumers' pockets. It was a closed circle. But that changes with the 1970s, and I think that's key to where we end up today with this search for cheap goods.
What changed in the 1970s? What was the switch?
So you have a number of things converging. One is we start deindustrializing, and that's globalization and the move of jobs offshore to cheaper labor markets. Also, unions begin their long decline. And by the late 1950s, and particularly starting in the 1960s, marketers embraced a concept called market segmentation. And the idea was figuring out how people were characterized by a different kind of lifestyle and therefore would buy different kinds of goods. And so what had been a kind of consumption for the good of the nation became a fulfillment of one's identity through consumption. And as people's economic capacities really declined, you know, people are less worried at this point about whether these goods are made in the United States. They're just not. And they're looking for the cheapest price.
So would you say that consumption, access to cheap goods, has it become linked to American identity?
Absolutely. The desire to have a car, to have a television, the latest version of it, to own a home, which is becoming increasingly difficult for many Americans, that has definitely defined people's sense of what they can expect as an American. And this is why I think we're going to face some serious challenges if, in fact, these tariffs raise prices. I think it's very much going to affect people's confidence. We're seeing consumer confidence at new lows. And we have to remember that 70% of our GDP is dependent on consumption. The economy will definitely suffer if people do not keep that cycle going.
Is there a way to reestablish that link between manufacturing and American identity?
That is definitely the ideal that the Trump administration has in mind, but I think it will play out differently. First of all, it takes a long time to build a factory. And when those factories are built, they are not going to be the kind of factories that prospered in the 1950s and into the 1960s. They're going to be very automated. They're going to have a lot of robotics, and they're going to require a smaller number of workers who have very sophisticated skills. Many working people are not attending college. They're not even getting very good high school educations, and they're not in a position to actually take on the jobs that are going to become available. That's one problem. The other, I would say, is that there really is an awareness, I think, among many Americans that waste leads to an environmental crisis. And when we continue to consume, we're only contributing to an environmental crisis in the world.
That's Elizabeth Cohen, professor at Harvard University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I very much appreciate the opportunity.
Students at Brown University say a culture of fear is growing on campus. That's as the federal government takes more steps to retaliate against the school for protests last year, including revoking the visas of some Brown students and expanding a civil rights investigation into the school. Olivia Eberts of Rhode Island member station The Public's Radio reports.
Last year, Brown University saw many campus demonstrations in favor of the Palestinian cause. There were regular rallies on the main green, a hunger strike, and over 60 students were arrested during the course of after-hours protests. But this year, it usually sounds closer to this. Students at Brown say protesting on campus has nearly vanished since the school punished demonstrators and banned its chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine.
A climate of fear, intimidation, censorship. That seems to be like the overwhelming atmosphere on campus.
That's Lifta, a Palestinian-Canadian doctoral student who's going by a childhood nickname because of her fears of deportation and detainment. These fears have gotten a lot more concrete since the Trump administration deported Brown Medical School professor Dr. Rasha Alawieh back to Lebanon. She admitted she had attended the funeral of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. Her lawyer says she was deported unjustly. The Trump administration has also revoked the visas of other members of the Brown community. Lifta's fears have also led her to change her plans to attend a conference and to see family in Canada. She's even asking her father not to come visit her to celebrate her recent engagement. He's originally from the Palestinian territories.
He's older, he's an older man, but he's just faced so much persecution at borders his whole life that I worry, like, the racial profiling, I'm sure, is going to be a problem for him, even on a Canadian passport.
Besides Lifta, I also spoke to a transgender PhD candidate here on a student visa who didn't want to use her name or be recorded for broadcast for fear of retribution. Although she's secured a prestigious tenure-track position for next year, she's considering declining it and moving back home, where she says she, quote, wouldn't be at the same risk of state violence. Here, she's concerned she could wind up in a men's prison. Many international students who do not feel vulnerable told me they still feel that things have really changed on campus. Here's German doctoral student Emmanuel, who asked that we only use his middle name out of concerns that Brown could revoke his funding.
It's much less self-evident that I will be supported by the university.
The school has been preemptively tightening its belt since even before the Trump administration threatened to withhold more than $500 million in federal funds. Now, Emmanuel said he might not be able to find funding to study ancient Greek, which is a foundational skill for his training in ancient Greek philosophy. Like many in the Brown community, Emmanuel moved thousands of miles across an ocean to attend a school where he thought he'd have the freedom and funding to pursue his academic career the way he wants. And Palestinian-Canadian doctoral student Lifta says students must pick up their activism once again to fight back against these financial cuts and crackdowns.
And so we have to also learn how to rebuild the morale in the face of excruciating loss, because we're in a position where we have a duty and obligation to continue.
It's not clear yet whether Brown University will cede to demands the federal government might make of them. But last week, hundreds of professors at Brown signed an open letter to the school's president. They called on her to use the school's more than $7 billion endowment to protect what they called a, quote, unprecedented assault on free speech in higher education. For NPR News, I'm Olivia Eberts in Providence.
The Grand Ole Opry turns 100 this year, meaning the live country music show, not the theater currently housing it. What makes the Grand Ole Opry the Grand Ole Opry is less the stage, but the many generations and styles of performers who've appeared on it. Over the past century, they have defined what we think of as country music. Here's Julie Height of Nashville Public Radio backstage at the Opry with a glimpse of the year-long celebration.
The Day of an Artist's inaugural performance on the Grand Ole Opry is full of rites and rituals. That includes a warm welcome from veteran staffer Jim Schermerhorn at the security desk.
I'm very excited about this. This is a dream come true.
Well, we're excited to have you here with us tonight.
Yes, sir.
This particular night, it's musical country comic Danae Hayes making her Opry debut. The artist behind impishly off-color hooks like this. Road hard and put up web. That one's about a used boat.
Now you're going to be in dress room number 4. And number 4 is the very first one on the left.
What he didn't say was that every first timer gets dressing room 4. It's tradition.
And while you're here, feel free to walk around and take it all in.
Yes, sir, I sure will.
But it's not like this is Hayes' first visit. Before an Opry debut comes a meeting with the people who run the show.
My name's Dan Rogers. I'm the senior vice president and executive producer of the Grand Ole Opry. Many, many times we're inviting folks to come and play for us, and that's not an audition at all, but it's a means of us
getting to know new artists. Sure, Hayes pushes the boundaries of country comedy a little. She blew up on TikTok, and her songs and characters don't keep it clean.
Gentlemen, making her Grand Ole Opry debut, please welcome Danae Hayes.
She ensured that her Opry set would go over by testing it out on her buttoned-up dad, who watched from the front row.
I'd always wondered where my ancestors were from, and so I ordered an online DNA test kit. So I got an email 2 days later. It said, "Miss Hayes, we hate to inform you, but we cannot trace your family roots past Arkansas."
Hayes closed with a musical number.
Mama's jaw about hit the ground that day that we found out that I had 4 brothers in Florida.
Hayes was one of 100 debuts planned for the Opry's anniversary this year. Rogers says there are 2 main goals behind all the festivities.
One, to celebrate the folks on whose shoulders we stand today, to look back really in awe and throw the doors wide open, put our hands out and welcome new artists ready to take the Opry into the next 100 years.
The Opry began in 1925 with a cobbled-together local cast on a radio station created to promote an insurance company. It went on to become a Saturday night smash with radio listeners and live audiences alike and catapulted its members to country stardom. But those days are long gone. Now its lineups are a mix of guest performers like Hayes and the 76 current country stars, bluegrass faves, and past hitmakers who make up the Opry's membership. One of them is John Conley, who opened the show.
This song got my whole career going, helped bring me to the Grand Ole Opry.
But these rose-colored glasses.
Conley had made his name with heartily delivered sentimental ballads when he joined the Opry in the early 80s. Like many veteran Opry members, Conley relishes performing the ceremonial act of inducting new members.
You know, when I joined and when I started hanging out here, I got to rub elbows and share the stage with people like Minnie Pearl and Roy Acuff and Bill Monroe and Hank Snow and Little Jimmy Dickens, all these people that I grew up listening to. All of a sudden, when I do the math, I'm part of the older generation out here now.
Conley's been around long enough to see an elder's admonition come true.
Porter Wagoner used to say, if you take care of the Opry as you're coming up, the Opry will take care of you later on in your career.
Though Conley hasn't had hits in decades, in the Opry's multi-generational lineups, he's still performing plenty, helping keep the show's traditions alive and evolving. For NPR News, I'm Julie Hite in Nashville.
I can remember us cruising through town in your daddy's car with the top pulled down, looking so cool. We came from different sides of the track, but we still held hands out back of the old school. We spent all our time together.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The Last of Us, HBO's hit drama set in a world where infectious zombies crave human flesh, returns for its second season tonight. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans says it's a compelling follow-up fueled by a shocking twist.
2 years ago, fans were transfixed by a story centered on TV's ultimate found family, a smuggler who bonded with a defiant, angry girl he was shepherding across a zombie-filled wasteland, to the point where he killed a building full of people just to save her life. So it might be jarring to find the new season of The Last of Us begins with Pedro Pascal's former smuggler, Joel Miller, estranged from Ellie, played by a plucky Bella Ramsey. Things are so bad that Joel, normally a strong, silent type, opens up to a friend about his relationship with Ellie, who he's come to see as a surrogate daughter.
Well, I figure it's normal. Her being 19 and me being her, what I am. No one likes their parents at that age. I never got there with my own kids, so we're both just figuring it out for the first time is all. I know I'm a hard ass and maybe overprotective and she's her. But, I mean, what did I do?
That question hangs over the entire season. Based on a popular video game, The Last of Us shows a highly infectious fungus turning people into zombies that make predictably creepy sounds. In the first season, Joel took on a job escorting Ellie, the only person known to be born with a resistance to the fungus, across the country to a medical facility. Each episode back then offered a different adventure, until they reached the hospital and Joel realized Ellie must die to synthesize a cure. So he took action, killed a bunch of people, and lied about it to Ellie. In the second season, that lie seems to weigh heavily on both of them, to the point where Joel consults a therapist named Gail, played by Catherine O'Hara, who has little patience for his complaints.
You have the most boring problem in the world.
Well, a 19-year-old daughter, she's acting toward me like every 19-year-old daughter has ever acted toward their dad.
Aren't you supposed to be validating me or something?
But I'm not going to do it anymore, because you're lying to me, and it's exhausting.
I've done this long enough to know when somebody is leaving something out, and you are definitely leaving something out.
Then she asked the real question on her mind.
Did you do something to her? Did you hurt her? Then what? What did you do?
I saved her.
What it takes to make the hard decisions about saving someone and the consequences it can bring is a consistent theme in this new season. Joel's instinct is to spare Ellie the weight of those tough choices by lying to her, even when the lies corrode their special relationship. Last season, The Last of Us avoided looking like other zombie shows by placing Joel and Ellie in different stories almost every episode. This season, much of the narrative is centered in the community where they settled, Jackson, Wyoming. Ellie has found a new type of infected zombie with a level of intelligence that might be considered
smart.
I'm not saying it could do math or anything, but it didn't run at me. It did what we do. Took cover, planned, waited, lured me in. Stalking.
Fans of the video game franchise know there is a terrible twist coming in the story, which changes everything. But it also shows the kind of tough choices that storytellers are willing to make on The Last of Us, building a new season that challenges the characters and the audience in exciting, unexpected ways. I'm Eric Deggans.
This is NPR News.
Since President Trump took office, some researchers feel emboldened to talk about the COVID lab leak theory. Others feel discouraged from discussing topics like climate change.
Science is about proposing new ideas and hypotheses. We can't do that if certain areas are deemed off limits.
Science and the State of the First Amendment on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The White House released today what it says are the results of President Trump's physical exam last week. His doctor says he exhibits excellent cognitive and physical health and is fully fit to serve as commander-in-chief. Authorities in Nigeria say 8 people were killed when a bus struck a roadside bomb yesterday. It happened in Nigeria's northeast Borno state, where the Boko Haram extremist group frequently launches attacks. And Expo 2025 opened in Osaka, Japan today. Organizers expect 28 million visitors until it closes in October. They'll be able to tour about 80 pavilions made by participants from more than 160 countries. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at Cunard.com. And from Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. For millennia, humans have feared and hated wolves. In recent memory, we've gunned them down to near extinction. Now conservation efforts in the United States and Europe are trying to bring them back. NPR's Ruth Sherlock went looking for wolves in the wild in Italy and found something unexpected in the end.
We walk with Valeria Rosselli, a guide with the group Wildlife Adventures.
La nostra sinistra parte un po' tutta l'area a nord.
We're in the National Park of Abruzzo, Lazio e Molise. It's just about 90 minutes from Rome, but it's another world. We're in an ancient forest where there are whispers of a distant past.
Viene da epoche lontane, remote, e dalle popolazioni pre-romane.
Pre-Roman populations worshipped in these woods to gods for the protection of trees and animals.
A protezione degli animali e delle foreste.
Rosselli now dedicates her life to help people of this era respect nature. For this trip, for 4 days, she will take us on a journey into the world of the wolf. After centuries of persecution that drove wolves to near extinction, their population has rebounded in recent decades. Italy is the European country with the most wolves. Their eerie, beautiful calls, like this one captured by the organisation Io non ho paura del lupo, I'm not scared of the wolf, can be heard across this region. We begin our expedition early.
It is just after 5:30 in the morning, and it is raining, and I mean really raining. But apparently one of the best times to see animals is just after dawn. Although, I can't imagine that wolves would want to be out in this rain any much more than we do.
We drive through the dark and the rain until dawn reveals the spectacle around us. Mountains pink in the morning sunshine, a lake that stretches down to a picturesque village. In this first hour, we see herds of deer grazing, wild boar and
big, healthy red fox. Doesn't seem bothered by us.
Wolves are much harder to find. Rosselli passes us binoculars and we sit still to watch for them.
This is one of the hard moments because we need to be very, 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 very patient.
The term pack for wolves really means a family. Two parents, wolves mate for life, and their young.
Avere un lupo in un ambiente naturale.
Having a wolf in an environment is a thing of prestige, Rosselli says.
The wolf's such an iconic species, and in England there's a lot of talk about missing predators, so
Steve Walker is a conservationist from the United Kingdom on this trip. The UK doesn't have apex predators, and Walker says without wolves or lynx, he struggles to protect the forest where he works from the large populations of deer that strip the ground of wildflowers and shrubs.
So you get really hollowed out, quiet woodlands, then you lose all the other species that go with it.
Wolves keep populations of deer and other ungulates down and on the move. They help keep the ecosystem in balance, and you can see the difference here in Italy, he says.
Stunning, stunning place with an intact natural ecosystem, just with the smallest chance of actually seeing a wolf in the wild. You just know they're out there, probably watching us.
One afternoon, Eros Zanotti, another in our party, takes a walk in the woods behind our hotel and... He's seen them. Two wolves, only meters away from him. The closest we get that day to seeing what we're after is the Wolf Museum in a nearby town.
Centro Visite del Lupo.
It was opened in the 1970s as part of a campaign to change the public's view of wolves as being big, bad creatures. Here's our guide, Rosselli, in English.
They decided to create the project to save from the extinction the Apennine wolf, the Italian wolf.
Museum paintings show the Saint Francis of Assisi leaning down to take the paw of a wolf.
He became friends with the wolves, and he talked with the wolves.
In this deeply Catholic country, the campaigners used the story of Francis to try to change Italians' perceptions of this animal for the better. It worked. There are now about 3,500 wolves in Italy, according to a government census. The next day, at dawn, we head out again to try to see them.
We're sitting in a line below a ridge on a hillside, and there's a plain below us of fields and woodland. We've been here for several hours. It's a really hard thing to do to see them.
I do come close to seeing what I've come for, thanks to someone from my pack.
Meanwhile, my husband has helpfully sent me a photo of a wolf.
We break at a cafe in a jewel of a village, Ortona dei Marsi, with its perfectly preserved medieval buildings. Like so many other rural places in Italy, it's almost empty these days.
Era un paese vivo, con tante attività. Artigianali, commerciali.
It was a place full of life, of artisans and local businesses, says Marina Eramo, who still lives in Ortona dei Marsi. But people moved to find jobs in cities, and with Italy's low birth rate, the countryside is emptying. And all this is leaving more space for animals.
I'm on a hiking trail with these majestic views of snow-capped mountains all around, there's juniper trees, pine forests, and this part of the trail overlaps with a route that wolves often use.
We come across wolf scat, excrement, with the hair of wild boar in it. Wolves hunt the weaker animals, and in doing so, they keep a species healthy. Trekking across the patches of remaining snow, we spot something exciting.
There's wolf prints in the snow.
Another one here.
And more in the fresh mud that follows.
For sure, you are around us, but before us, before our passage.
Just missed them. Amazing. You're so close.
We're so close, but not close enough. The wolves don't show themselves on this trip, but I feel closer to them somehow, these intelligent creatures with family structures that are not so different to our own. And in searching for them, I've learned more about myself, about the importance of taking moments to sit quietly in these frenetic times. I leave feeling calmer and reminded of how much we are a part of and need the natural world. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Abruzzo, Italy.
There's more wildlife later today on All Things Considered. Scientists think they may have found an efficient way to track various species, and it comes from a surprising source. Stations used to monitor pollution can also capture the airborne DNA of wildlife. It may be less fun than tracking wolves through Abruzzo, but it can provide an extraordinary snapshot of biodiversity in the region. Learn more this afternoon on your phone, your smart speaker, or your radio. In the new children's book, The Littlest Drop, birds sang in the trees as monkeys swung through their branches. Snakes slithered around their trunks, and giant cats crept silently below. On one small branch of one tall tree, a tiny hummingbird.
The hummingbird has just built her nest, and a fire breaks out.
The Littlest Drop is Sasha Alper's first picture book, based on a parable from the indigenous Quechua people of South America.
All of the animals flee to the river, except for the little hummingbird. She goes and gets just one little drop of water, because that's all she can hold. Finally, the largest animal, the elephant, asks her, "Little hummingbird, what are you doing? You can't put out this fire." And she says, "I'm doing what I can."
So my father was originally going to illustrate this story.
That's two-time Caldecott Honor winner, Brian Pinckney.
So my father's Jerry Pinckney. He's won a Caldecott Award. He's won about four, I think, Caldecott Honor Awards. And it's just prolific, probably one of the most prolific children's book illustrators that ever has been in America. And he passed away. So this was his last unfinished project.
For our series, Picture This, Sasha Alper and Brian Pinckney talk about how their children's book brought some of Jerry Pinckney's final illustrations to life.
A publisher called me and said, "You know, now that your father isn't alive anymore, would you like to finish his book?" And my first thought was, how am I going to do this? He was a master at doing animals, and I've done like maybe a couple animals on a spread, but never like 20. And I thought, I'm going to have to do like the hummingbird and just do one little paint stroke at a time.
You know, I've been reading your father's books since I was very young. My father owned bookstores, so I had so many of them. For me, I'm just so overjoyed that you both illustrated it. I mean, I know it's very bittersweet,
mm-hmm.
but I got really lucky.
You know, it was interesting. I spent my whole childhood watching him illustrate his books. I would come home from school and spend time in his studio and watch him while he was drawing, and I would learn how he worked, and then he would give me techniques, and I would practice doing them in my own little home studio, which I had set up in my room. Actually, it was a walk-in closet that my mother took all the clothes out, and I'd practice doing what I saw him doing. So I knew his technique very well, yet my style went in a little bit of a different direction.
I just think that the collaboration between the two of you is so beautiful, because your dad did have such an amazing way with just the extraordinary expressiveness of animals, but the incredible way that you show movement and your use of color, the way it dramatizes the story, I just think that it's so beautiful together.
My dad was much more detailed orientated than I am. I'm much more fluid, a little impressionistic, energetic in a way, and broader strokes. And also, I couldn't draw as small as him. What he did with this book was, I realized once upon reading it, he tested himself, like he always does with his artwork, to reach farther. So he had done a dummy book, a very small dummy book. I think a lot of it out of his head, with many back views of animals and little ants the size of original ants. I had to actually blow up his dummy book like 300% so that I could see it. And then I just started sketching, and I started painting using the materials that I like, watercolor and acrylic. So after that, I would have a beautiful painting in watercolor. And then I would have to go back in with a black ink line to highlight his lines that would also draw the characters, the different animals, yet in my style of painting. So it was kind of like a meditation in a way, because I literally was combining my dad's structure, like the architecture of his drawing, with my brushstroke. And once that was done, I went back over that then with acrylic, and I built up the color that way. And I would use the color palette that my dad had used in some of his books, like The Lion and the Mouse. That's one of his classics.
You know, you use so many different things in it. Some of the pages really look just, you know, peaceful, and you have those softer colors. And the way you'll do the sort of gradations of color, I love that, you know, with the watercolors, how it sort of subtly changes color. And it really, it makes it look like movement, but it's so subtle that it took me a few times of looking at it to realize that. And I also love, there's a whole spread in the middle that's two pages of just fire. And having read this to some kids now, they are just riveted by that picture. They like drama, they like action, and that fire feels so alive.
The characters are the hummingbird, the elephant, the giraffe, the crocodile, the hippopotamus. There are lots of characters. And I also saw the fire as a character. So it was important that the fire kind of grow and have a presence in the book. And then the presence diminishes as the fire goes out.
It was very much an environmental book to start. And while I think it is still very much that, and the climate crisis only worsens, I do now see it as broader than that. You know, I really thought about this little hummingbird a lot. I really wanted a good ending for her. As a children's book, you know, children are dreamers, and they need to keep hope. Children now are facing an incredibly challenging world in so many ways, and they are going to have to do what they can, all of them. And they're going to have to keep hope that they can make the world a greener, better, more just place.
That was author Sasha Alper and illustrator Brian Pinkney talking about their new children's book, The Littlest Drop, which was also illustrated by the late, great Jerry Pinkney. Our series, Picture This, is produced by Samantha Balaban. For more conversations like this one, head to npr.org/picturethis. This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From Capital One, with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.